Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer. And today I'm very privileged to welcome Ron Rabot to the podcast. His family farms in southeastern Wyoming in the little town of, I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong, I'm going to say it's Albin. Am I close, Ron, on the pronunciation?
You are correct on the town. And okay. It's pronounced Albin, and then it's actually Rabo.
So I screwed up your name already. You know, that's the, of course, you know, my name is Niefer, which has been pronounced Niefer, Niefer, Nefer. You know, there's about 17 different pronunciations for my name. So,
my wife's maiden name is May, and she said that before we got married, they even messed that up.
Well, and I could see May, Mae, you know, I could see where that could be. Yeah, that could be a little bit. And I noticed on Wikipedia, it said that your population was 181 in the town. Now, the little town of Dixie where I grew up, well, I was on a farm outside of Dixie. It was a whopping, I think, 129 when I was there. So so you actually have my hometown beat by a little bit.
Well, our town always, the sign always used to say 120. I honestly think 181 might have been counting cats and dogs. And so I think 181 is stretching it.
Yeah. Well, and I have a bad joke. I probably shouldn't even share it on the podcast, but I will. You know, when I talk about growing up on the farm near Dixie, and of course, we have a lot of steep hills in the area. I have 450 of elevation change and 150 acre little farm there. My joke about Dixie is if a husband and wife get divorced, are they still brother and sisters? So, you know, that's the type of town I grew up in. So, but really this podcast isn't about me. It's about you, Ron. So, let's go into, just give us a description, a brief description of your farm operation. Maybe when did it start? I know it didn't exactly start with you, which is typical of most farm operations. Right. How it's evolved and how's it managed and all that good stuff.
You know, so I'm actually fifth generation out here. My great-great-grandparents moved here from the Midwest, which I'll never understand. it doesn't make sense to me why you would move from a beautiful place like Illinois and head west and land out here where there's no trees, there's no water, there's no people. Yep. There's literally nothing but prairie and settle down and say, I think this looks good. But nonetheless, that's what they did. You know, they came out here in the 1870s. My great grandfather was actually be my great great grandfather. So I misspoke already there, but it's my great great grandfather was a stonemason and he helped build the Union Pacific Depot in Cheyenne, which is still in the town. It's kind of an iconic structure in town today. And he helped also build the Wyoming State Capitol building. And he died in the early 1900s. And my great-great-grandmother decided that she wanted to eventually, you know, move out of town and have a place of her own. And so my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandmother moved out, homesteaded their own properties here. And then eventually his siblings came out and homesteaded some of their properties as well. And so that was, you know, many of us are familiar with the Homestead Act that took place to try to get people to settle the West and they were part of that. And so they came out and settled that and then eventually grew, you know, as time moved forward, you know, they began to take over, you know, different siblings had left the properties that they had homesteaded. My great-great-grandmother bought some of those. My great-grandfather bought some of those. And so their places eventually just kind of evolved. Although for those days, you know, you didn't cover a lot of ground. Farms weren't large, obviously, in those days. And so when my great-great-grandmother had passed away, my great-grandfather was the only one left that had any kind of really ranching property at all. And so, He had three children, two boys and a girl. My grandfather was one of those boys, and then as that operation got passed down, my grandfather's brother had passed away, And the ranch that I grew up in was my grandfather, my dad, and my dad's two first cousins. And so, you know, I call it the compound that I grew up on. And so there was really just this compound, you know, where we had all these buildings. We had four houses that were really, you know, for all intents and purposes, were just makeshift buildings that ended up being houses.
Yep.
And that's where I grew up. And so, we had a ranch where we had about 250 to 300 cows on any given year. We raised a little bit of wheat. We raised some oats and some corn just to feed the calves that we were backgrounding in our lots at home. But the dilemma on our ranch is that even though my great-great-grandparents, my great-grandparents had come here and they had settled and they had made a lot of changes in their own lives and they had made a lot of changes in their own operations, obviously to adapt to, you know, changing times, from about 1960 or so on, our ranch really didn't change. It changed a little bit, but not enough to keep up with changing times. And so we know what agriculture's done in the last 20 years, even, and there's been massive changes in the industry. And so by the time I was in college, you know, it was the discussion around our operation was, how are we ever going to pass this to the next generation? Because there was my grandfather who had actually stopped drawing any kind of income from the farm. But there was my dad and his two cousins who were the same age, you know, in their late 50s, early 60s, talking about how in the world they were going to have enough to retire, because the most that any of them ever made working on that ranch was $600 a month. And so that's what my parents raised us on. I mean, we all know this story because it's a familiar story, you know, across the board in production agriculture, but there just wasn't enough there. And so the discussion, you know, involving that transfer, that generational transfer, was always a conversation that took place between my dad and I. And it was kind of that we had a buy-sell agreement. And the buy-sell agreement with the ranch operation said that the ranch could only ever be passed to sons. And there was myself was a son, and my dad's cousin's son was the other son. And the rest of my cousins were all females. And so the only people that the ranch could ever be passed to was my cousin and myself. And my cousin was really never on the radar with his dad, because he was, A, he was not interested, and B, he had created a lot of trouble for himself. And so he was not really ever a candidate to even, have this thing passed down to. And so, knowing that, my dad would always kind of groom me to, you know, say, hey, can you come back and help us do this? Can you help us do that? And so when I grew up, of course, I spent a lot of time around the ranch helping, but we were primarily a cattle operation. And so I grew up on horseback being a cowboy, and I just never, I really never loved it. So, when I was 26 years old, my dad was 58. He had invited me to come back and help them wean calves for a couple of days. And so I was actually the director of the Wyoming FFA Foundation at the time, and took a couple of days off of work, came back helping them wean calves. And my dad and I were doing all the vaccinating and everything in the alleyways. And his cousins were, you know, pushing cattle down. And of course, you know how it is when you're working cattle, everyone loves each other. And they're always super supportive and very encouraging, you know, uplifting. And so this day was no different. It was a blustery November day, November 4th, 1999. And I went to fill a vaccine gun, and I turned around, and my dad was gone. And I looked into the chute, and he was lying on his back. And I jumped into the chute and put my hand under his head, and he had kind of opened his mouth like to say something. And I told him, I said, just relax. It's all right. Just, you know, take a deep breath. And his lips began to turn blue, and then his whole face turned blue. And his cousin and I drug him out, and we performed CPR on him. And it was, it was a surreal moment in my life. And it was very close to my dad. He and I did everything together. I always considered him my best friend. He was my hunting partner, my confidant, my mentor. And I remember as I was giving him CPR, that your whole, it's a surreal moment because your whole life kind of flashes before you. It's like it's swirling around you, and all of these hopes and dreams and expectations and plans that you had for your life are swirling around you. And, you know, you're in a panic. Yeah. And all I could think is that we've just got to keep doing this because he's going to wake up. We just have to keep doing it. And then the ambulance showed up and then they took over. And I thought he has to wake up. I mean, this can't be a real moment.
Right. Right.
And the realization of that moment, you know, took actually weeks to soak in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that I looked at one of the paramedics once and I was crying and I just said, you can't stop. You have to keep doing this. And, you know, the look in his eyes was, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah.
And I remember we loaded him in the ambulance and we met him, you know, from the ambulance from Cheyenne and went to the ICU unit in the hospital there. And I just remember panicking and shaking and crying and just thinking there's just no way that this is happening right now. And that night, of course, it was the longest night that I ever remember in my life. And and the next day, my mom and my sister and I got together and we got together with the doctor, and the doctor said, I don't know what happened. We think he had a heart fibrillation, but he was probably gone before he hit the ground.
Yeah.
And we made this choice of, you know, pulling him from life support. And and that was the moment that my life changed forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I always had this expectation that being the fifth generation and not really being a cattle guy, but my dad and I always talked about, you know, we can figure this thing out. We can make this thing work. You know, when some of the other partners get out, obviously it looked like no one else was going to get, you know, included in the operation other than myself. The one partner didn't even have a son. And so we just kind of figured, you know, that eventually it would be he and I, and we would take this thing over and we would be able to make it cash flow and be able to make it work. Because all the other partners, you know, they would come into our house every day and ask my dad what they needed to do. He was the hub that made the wheel turn. And when you live, and there's a lot of people that will understand this when I say this, but when you grow up on a compound in an operation that has extended relatives and even immediate family, that everyone pretends to get along. And on some operations, they do get along. But the moment that things change and the moment that the hub is broken, the moment that that wheel is gone, then the rest of the wheels start to fall off in the operation.
Yep.
And unfortunately, people's true colors and their true character begins to shine through. And for the next 4 years of my life, I ended up buying my dad's shares to get back in the operation. My grandparents were completely heartbroken. I ended up taking care of them until they passed away. My grandpa got to the point where he couldn't even go to the bathroom on his own, change his clothes on his own, or feed himself. And it was their daughter had completely removed herself from them. And it ended up being this same family tree with two completely different branches. And those two completely different branches on that tree became extremely evident when my dad was no longer there. When that buffer zone was no longer there, things changed. And I'll never forget when people from our community came over to help and they told one of my dad's cousins, you know, you guys need to be a family, you need to go up there to the hospital. His response was, we've got a ranch to take care of and Ed's family will just have to figure it out. And a couple of years later, you know, your grandpa's no good around here. He never did any good for anyone around here. Put him in a rest home and forget about him. You taking care of your grandpa has taken a lot of time away from this ranch. And what I began to realize, what began to become clear to me was that the ranch was what was important, not the people. that were on the ranch. And I think that we lose perspective. I know that we lose perspective in a lot of things in life, but because I'm involved in production agriculture and because I've lived this, we lose perspective in agriculture and production agriculture because our farms and our ranches become our priorities. They become what's important. They become, in a sense, they become our God.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to lose focus because we have everything that we are and generations before us who have built this operation. And I just remember saying to myself, when I had finally decided that I had had enough at our ranching operation, that I was going to leave, knowing that I was going to have to leave a lot behind because we thought we had things square with the buy-sell agreement and with the transitional process. We did not. There were mistakes.
Yeah.
And my family paid for that mistake, and that meant me. I had to pay for it. So when I left the ranch, I had to leave a significant portion that I owned at the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to leave with less if I was ever going to leave. But we finally made that choice to do that because I remember saying to my wife that I don't know what we're going to do, but I do know one thing for sure, and that is that we are not going to do this.
Right.
We didn't have any kids at the time, but I said, I'm not raising my kids in this environment. I'm pretty sure I can't stay married in this environment, and I certainly can't keep the proper perspective in this environment.
Yeah.
And so we ventured out, and things had just become enormously ugly, and there were other family members that they had started to pull back in, and it just was a mess. And I thought, there's no way that this thing is going to work over the long haul. And if it does, I'm not going to be part of it. And so we ended up down on my grandparents' place, which is about a mile and a half from where I grew up from the compound. And this, incidentally, was the place that my great-great-grandmother had actually purchased. So the north half of the section where we live on was the oldest piece of deeded ground in my family's history. And so this particular place has been around for a long time. And, you know, we had a lot of old, and I mean old equipment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Small stuff. We just, our focus really wasn't farming, and we didn't farm a lot of ground. And what I found is that when you take 40% of an operation that doesn't work when it performs at 100%, it doesn't work very well at 40% either.
No.
And so you can imagine what those numbers look like. And so we struggled for a lot of years. And I remember having to take equipment behind the farm away from the road and putting it in a field, trying to figure out how it worked, because I didn't know how it worked. I had this old 4440 that my grandpa had. And, you know, it was getting to the point where it was in pretty rough shape. And this equipment, you know, I'd never pulled a lot of it. I'd never planted an acre of anything. And I just flat didn't know how to use it. So I ended up hiring some neighbors to come in and help. And I had this section of farm ground. Then I had another quarter that I was farming. And we just got to the point where we discovered over a period of about 4 years that there's no way we're going to make it on this place. In fact, my accountant sat down with me and he said, you know, you're going to lose everything else that you have unless you figure this thing out.
Yeah.
Because he said the way that this is going right now is not in a positive direction.
Right.
And right. So I had kind of decided, well, you know, I think I'll go back and maybe I'll get my teaching degree. I have a bachelor of science in ag business. And I thought I can, you know, go for a couple of years. I'll get my teaching degree. I can farm my section here in the summertime and then I'll just teach or something in the wintertime. And I never realized how hard teachers had to work until I married one. But I remember coming home from class one day and telling my wife, I said, I'm pretty sure that in these teaching classes, if I have to talk about my feelings anymore, that someone's going to get hurt. And she laughed at me and she said, yeah, I didn't think that that was probably going to work for you. But, you know, you had your mind made up that that's what you were going to do. So at that point, I gave up that venture and I began to take a long, hard look at my operation. And for the first time in my life, I started looking at my operation as a business, not as a family heirloom.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
That's really hard to do because like, I get it, right? Like, I mean, it was enormously difficult for me to leave the ranching operation because that's the only life I knew.
Yep. Yep.
And I was sentimentally attached to a lot of the things that were at that operation. And not for really any particular business reason. It was just that that's what I knew and that's what was comfortable. And I didn't really want to have to step out and change anything. And because I changed and because I became the black sheep, I had already discovered that, you know, if I was going to try to make it on my own, I was going to have to get really good at understanding how to really, in a sense, force change upon myself and become more adaptable,
right,
and
right.
more flexible. And so we took a long, hard look at our operation. We had some pasture ground, and we ended up, through the business plan that we drew up, we ended up selling off over 85% of everything that we owned. And you have to understand that the place that my grandparents lived on, God bless them, they just didn't fix things up. I mean,
yeah.
all the money that the ranch had went into the compound.
Right.
And so, so this place was, you know, it was in need. It was in dire need of construction
yeah.
and rehabilitation, right?
A little TLC.
The equipment was, yeah, times 10. Right. And
yeah.
So the equipment was not going to work, and we ended up selling off over 85% of what we owned. And I thought, you know, I think I can make this work farming. And so we began to build our farm. And so over the past 15 years, we've just been blessed. And I'm certainly a believer that God's given us free will, but unless we exercise that free will and we're willing to make hard choices for ourselves, that with that guidance and with that divine intervention and with our willingness to make hard choices and with our willingness to change and undergo, you know, and face really things that were that, you know, a lot of what I was doing, I had fear, you know,
yep.
a lot of times we don't step out of that comfort zone because we are scared.
Yep.
But
yep.
over the last 15 years, we've been very blessed to build a farm that, that now we farm over 8,000 acres organically. We've purchased about 50% of that over time. We have completely overhauled our infrastructure here on the farm. Everything that is on the farm has a purpose. And we've torn buildings down. We've repurposed a lot of buildings. We've completely overhauled the house. We have added about 150,000 bushels of storage on air. We have completely overhauled. The only thing that I have that I started with for equipment is that old 4440. And it's repainted and overhauled, and it looks awesome.
There's lots of 4440s and 4420s out there and 4020s and so on, so.
Yeah, it's just a great tractor, but that is my piece of history that says, you know, this is where I came from. And I think it's always important to keep that perspective. And so when we began to build our farm, it was hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't lie to you. I mean, I talk about this in my last book that I wrote, but I talk about it when I'm on the road speaking too, that living in a small community and growing up on a ranch and being an agent of change is like being a crab in a bucket.
Yep.
That you can actually take, a bunch of crabs, you can put them in a bucket, and those crabs will actually die in the bucket. But every single one of those crabs can get out of the bucket, but they won't. And the reason that they don't is because when one starts to reach over the edge with its claw and pull himself in, the other ones pull him back in.
Yeah.
And that is what I experienced in my community, unfortunately. It's what I experienced certainly in my family, that when you start to crawl out, all the forces in the bucket and all the crabs in the bucket grab you, and they pinch you and they hurt you as much as they can, and they rip you away from the side and they pull you back in the bucket.
Yeah.
Unless you have enough internal fortitude to say, I'm not going to get I may get knocked down, but I'm not going to stay down. And I'm going to continue to reach that edge. No matter how much I'm ripped back into the bucket, I'm going to crawl out.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do as people. We have to keep that perspective, and we have to have that internal fortitude and that tenacity to be able to say, I am not going to give in. I am not going to give up. I believe I have a purpose. I believe I live in the freest country in the world. Yeah. I believe that my choices matter. I believe that I can create my own path. I believe that I can make my own way. I believe that I can make a difference for myself and my family.
Yeah.
And really, that's the attitude that we've had when we've grown this farm, and we've been blessed. And so that is a long route to answer your question, to say that, you know, there's a lot of history here.
Yeah.
And we can, I honor my history, and I respect my history, and I value my history tremendously. But just because we value something, and just because something's important to us, doesn't mean that what we do has to be the exact same thing in the exact same way that it's always been.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We are responsible for our own choices, for our own way, and for our own destiny. And it's really up to us to make those choices to move us in the direction that really shows that, look, my family's important.
Yep.
My community is important. My marriage is important.
Yeah.
The entity is important, but the entity cannot any longer be the master.
Right. Can't be more important than the rest of that. So, that's quite a history there. Hey, Ron, we're going to go ahead and take a short break for a sponsor message right now, and then we'll come back and finish up the podcast. But we'll go ahead and take our break right now.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast. I'm your moderator, Paul Niefer, and we're going to go ahead and continue our discussion here with Ron. Ron, I guess when I hear you say you're organic in southeastern Wyoming, and I don't know if I've been through Alvin, but I know I've been very close. So I know what that area looks like. I've been through Cheyenne and Potter and Torrington and all that area, Wheatland, quite a bit. What type of crops are you growing? I would guess organic wheat, but that's a guess on my part. I'm just curious, what type of organic crops are you growing in that area?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had a lot of people tell me over the years that when I go speak, they always come up to me afterwards and say, wow, we didn't even know there were farms in Wyoming. We thought it was all, you know, it's all mountains and pasture, right? And for the most part, that is correct. We are an anomaly for sure on our farm. We grow crops that no other farms in Wyoming grow, because there are. There's a very, very limited amount of farms.
Yeah.
If you take the entire agriculture industry in the state of Wyoming, and this includes cattle, sheep, hay, all grains, it's barely $1 billion.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, I mean, that's nothing when you look at, you know, the pork industry in Iowa. It's just $36 billion.
Yeah,
you know, is what it contributes to the Iowa. And then that's just the pork industry. So in our neck of the woods, most everyone is a summer fallow and wheat farmer.
Mm-hmm,
and for those people that don't understand what summer fallow is, for those of us that live in 14 to 16 inches of annual precipitation like we do at 5,300 feet elevation, we have to fallow some of our acres so that we can build that decomposition for the in the soil for the crop that came first, you know, sweet stubble, for an example. We break it down,
help build that moisture back up and usually plant winter wheat back into it. We've stepped out of that mold on our farm. We are in the organic business. And when I looked at building my farm, the reason that we went organic is because it just made economic sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with, you know, $4 and $5 wheat at the time, and really even some of it was below $4, I thought there's just no way that, you know, how can you buy even a used tractor for $250,000, let alone, you know, three or four or five of them, plus all the other support equipment that goes along with that. How can you do that on $3.5 or $4 wheat?
Yeah. Yeah,
for the acres that we're talking out here? You can't. And so we have developed this system in our operation that relationships matter. And so we focus on building relationships, really three key factors: communication, trust, and relationships. And if you have a breakdown of any one of those, especially in the organic business, it doesn't run very well, because our farm, I looked at my farm and I said, you know, what everyone does out here is they raise a crop and then they take that crop to the elevator and they say, what will you give me for it?
Yeah, yeah.
And then they come home and they complain about it. And I thought, I think we need to just look at the inverse of that. Like, is there any way that I can go find a market first, develop a buyer first, find out what the consumer need is, find out what that buyer's need is based on the consumer demands, and work backward from there?
Yeah. Yeah.
And develop my cash flows from there. So that's what we've done. We've just worked everything backwards from what the traditional farm does. And so as a result of that, we've found that, of course, wheat is a staple crop for us in this neck of the woods. But what we've found through lots of trial and error is that, and through lots of, you know, discovery with different types of equipment, that we can raise other crops besides wheat. And the consumers, because of agree with it or disagree with it, doesn't matter. The consumer is demanding gluten-free products.
Yep.
The consumers, not all of the consumers, but about, you know, a good portion of consumers are demanding organic products.
Yep.
You can agree or disagree with that, but it doesn't matter from my perspective. From my perspective, the only thing matters is what the consumer wants. And if the consumer is willing to pay more for a product that I might not raise as many acres, but if I can focus more on quality and more on what the consumer wants and they're willing to pay me significantly more for it, why would I not
pursue
that? Especially in an area where we're limited with rainfall, we're limited on cropping opportunities. And so as a result, over the period of time that we've been building our farm, this year we've planted yellow field peas, which actually go into meatless meat. Pea protein is one of the main protein ingredients that goes into meatless meat. Will I ever eat meatless meat? Probably not. But there's a lot of people out there that will.
Yep.
And so I'd be crazy not to raise a product that meets that demand.
Yep.
We've been experimenting with flax over the last couple of years. This year we dove more into the flax market. And so we discovered that we can raise that here, even with limited rainfall. I was the primary individual that lobbied the hemp bill in Wyoming. And for me, it was about crop diversification. Obviously, the federal government through the farm bill has deregulated the production of hemp. And so I had an interest in it from a small grain perspective, because hemp is the highest protein crop that we can raise in the United States, just second behind soybeans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I heard a guy in economics talk several years ago at a conference that I was at, and he said that we're undergoing the largest shift of people moving in the world from poverty to middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that he asked was, what's the number one thing that people do when they move from poverty to middle class? And the answer to that is they eat more protein.
Right. Right.
So we know that not all of this is going to come from animal protein. We know that a portion of this, in fact, a very large portion of this, is going to come from plant protein.
Right.
So
right.
You look at the peas, the crops like peas, high protein, hemp, high protein, and some of these other crops that are high protein. And so we've gotten into the hemp business, and we're raising that strictly from a small grain standpoint. We raise buckwheat, which actually goes into malting grains.
Mm-hmm.
We raise proso millet,
okay.
Which is a very good, diverse, gluten-free grain.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all of these grains, of course, are gluten-free except
right.
wheat.
Right.
And then we raise a fair amount of chickpeas as well.
Okay.
And
okay.
so people always want to know what chickpeas are. And I tell them that, if you've ever been to a salad bar, they're the container of beans that no one eats, right?
Right.
Big round
right.
beans.
Yeah.
But, people like hummus. And so,
yep.
of course, that's what a lot of bars goes to. Yep. And so those are the crops that we raise, but we are the only organic farm that raises some of those crops in Wyoming, and we are the only farm that raises some of those crops in the entire state, conventionally and organically. But we've just decided that, I'm just probably stupid enough that I, or crazy enough that if someone says, hey, can you, when I'm out and about, communicating with buyers and trying to figure out what consumer demands are, when they come to me and they say, can you grow this? And I say, I don't know, but I'll try.
Yeah.
And so as a result of that, that's how we've tried all these crops, and that's how we've come about growing all of these. And so we have a line of dedicated gluten-free equipment. We have a line of dedicated gluten-free storage. And so in our business, in the organic business and in, the gluten-free business and some of these other grains that we're raising, it's more management intensive.
Yeah.
It's more time intensive. It's more financially intensive. But there's a profit there and the economics work. And I've also found that not only do the economics work, but I feel that because I'm involved in an industry that is really based on relationships, I've found that I really am fascinated and I'm blessed to be able to work with the people that I work with. We have a tremendous amount of grain buyers that really support our farm as
mm-hmm.
an individual farm.
Yep.
And our goal on our farm is not to become, kind of the coin of the realm for farms in America is bigger is better.
Right.
And to
right.
a degree, that volume has to happen, and it has to happen to a degree on our farm as well, just to be able to keep up with changing times. But our goal on our farm is to focus less on getting bigger and to focus more on getting better.
Yeah.
And so we're always trying to, we make mistakes all the time. We have crop disasters all the time. We've got some this year, but we always just want to put our best foot forward. And I've found that by doing that, that we can make our farm better. It's not an immediate process. It's not immediate gratification, but it is something that over the long haul, it's a commitment that we've made to the consumer. It's a commitment that we've made to our buyer. It's a commitment that we've made to our employees and to our own individual family. And it's one that we find year in and year out is working for our individual farm.
Ron, I know, we've had a great discussion on the farm operation, but you're not only a farmer, you're also a speaker and have written, I think, more than one book. So let's just do a quick little dive into what type of speaking you do, what type of book and so on for our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I'm extremely passionate about is writing and speaking. I've been a professional speaker for over 20 years. And so I've talked about a variety of topics, worked with a variety of industries over those years. But my primary focus now is really in the agriculture industry. And
mm-hmm.
so typically when I go talk anymore, it's really about the agriculture, the organic agriculture front, and then also family farm transition. I really feel that family farm transition is the white elephant in the room.
Yeah.
And it's the subject that people don't want to talk about. I think that it's fair to say that none of us really want to talk about our own demise.
Yeah.
But in doing so, we tend to push that off onto the next generation or maybe even to our spouse or our children. And I can tell you through my own personal experience, that's not a fair position to put those people into.
Yeah, totally agree.
And so these are discussions because it's going to happen, whether you talk about it or not, the white elephant still exists.
Yep.
And it will always be there and it will always get bigger. and it will always get meaner as time moves forward. And so I found that just like in my, the three priorities that we focus on our farm, communication, trust, and relationships, we have to focus on that in our own individual lives too.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've found on my own individual operation is that the more we focus on people and the more we focus on keeping them as a priority, the more successful our farm becomes.
Yep.
And that doesn't mean if I'm focusing more on my marriage or on me being a dad to three boys or with my employees, that if I can focus on the people part of things, everything else works. But if I do things in a bass-ackward sense and I begin to focus more on the operation and less on the people, that's when things start to fall apart.
Yep.
And
yep.
So when I go speak to organizations, these are the things that I talk about. And so my latest book is called Make Your Own Way. And it's really about our story. It's really about how we broke the mold and how we achieved independence in American agriculture. I mean, we've broken away. And,
yep.
And I remember telling my dad at the hospital bed when we knew that we were going to pull life support. And I remember just standing there shaking and holding his hand and sweating and just knowing it was the last time that I would ever feel his leathery skin. And it was the last time that I would ever be able to talk with him in the same room. And I remember telling him that no matter what happens, I'll fulfill your legacy. And people know what I'm talking about when I say that.
Yeah.
Because what I meant is that no matter what happens, I'm going to carry this ranch forward.
Yep.
And I don't care if I've got to move mountains. I'm going to make sure that this ranch works because that's what you work so hard for.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until about 10 years later when I was writing a speech for an organization that I had just given it considerable thought over those years. And I remember writing that speech saying, man, my dad's legacy is not the ranch.
Right.
My dad's legacy is not what he did. His legacy was who he was and who he taught me to be.
Right.
And that's what we have to keep a focus on. And that's really what my book is about. It's about, you know, not just our story, but how do we get past these things that we're so, we have the blinders on, or maybe we have a mental block, or maybe we're just fearful to have the conversation. We're fearful for change. But what I share in my book is that if you'll just face that change, and if you'll just do something different, and if you'll just make some hard choices,
yeah,
it's going to be rough at first, but you'll discover things that you never knew were possible. You'll discover that you're capable of things that you never understood that you were capable of. You'll discover that you can have a better marriage. You can be a better dad. You can have I never had this dream of having this farm that we have now. I was just trying to survive and pay my grocery bill.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, really, that's really all it boiled down to. But what I found is that through a series of hard, hard choices, and I understand those choices because I've been there and I've had to make them. And I've lived the fear part. I mean, we still undergo that. I mean, just because we don't ever get past the other side and say, well, we're on a plateau, so now everything is great. I mean, we're still undergoing massive change in our operation and our family and our employee structure and all these things, but we just have to continue to push forward. But if we'll just do that, we might discover that life can be better than we ever even imagined it ever could be.
Yep.
And that's my point. You know, my first book is called Keep It Simple, and it's 12 core values that lead to personal and professional success. And I had a radio show with my best friend, actually, at the time. He and I co-wrote the book together, and we were speaking all over the country. And really, that's about keeping the focus on the things that are important in your life, that as adults, we have a tendency to devalue the simple things in life. And we hear the phrase all the time, stop and smell the roses. Yeah, got it, whatever. But it's true.
Yeah.
That we have a tendency to overcomplicate everything. And if we'll just look at the simple things in life and stop trying to overcomplicate everything and focus on the things that are really important, that instead of my dad's partner saying, you should forget about your grandpa and put him in a rest home, the conversation should have been, How can we help you?
Yeah.
You know, is there anything that your grandparents need?
Yeah.
Because that pays dividends in the long run.
Yeah.
And so those are, you know, kind of a 30,000 foot view of what I speak about and what I write about. My books can be found on Amazon, by Googling by searching my name.
Yeah.
RABOU. And they can also be found on rabofarms.com and on ronrabo.com.
Yeah. Yeah. You're great.
And so all my contact information is there. And, one of my favorite things to do is to go speak to organizations, speak to individuals, whether it's in a consulting capacity or whether it's in a, you know, larger group capacity, to work with them and help them get through this transition process and to really expose the fact that, look, if I did it, and I'm just some simple dude from southeastern Wyoming who lives on the plains where the wind blows 90 plus miles an hour in the wintertime. I can do it, you can do it too.
Hey, we're getting close to the end of the podcast here, and I always end with a couple questions. And the first question I have, and I think you've covered it a little bit already, but I just want to clarify it, is there anything that keeps you up at night? What keeps you up at night that you ponder on or worry about? What's the thing that keeps you up at night?
You know, that's changed from year to year. And to be just downright honest with you right now, the thing that keeps me up at night is not necessarily anything that revolves around my family and around my, I guess in a sense, it revolves around my family and my farm, but it's the state that we find our country in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're moving in such a direction right now that we're losing our perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have that perspective and we don't understand, like, we're trying to erase history.
Yeah.
So if I were to erase history on my farm and say, oh, look at this great, wonderful thing that I have, and then I become something that I'm really not.
Right.
And that's right. That's what I find our country doing, is that we're erasing our history, and we're erasing the fact that there's value in that history.
Yep.
We're taking the people out of things, and competency is no longer a qualification for anything.
Right. Right.
And we find ourselves as business people and as entrepreneurs wanting to find people that just want to show up to work, let alone actually work when they get there.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter where I travel. I've been in probably, I don't know, 8 or 10 states the month of June.
Yeah.
And it's the same everywhere. It doesn't matter who I talk to. Everyone is undergoing the same challenges.
Yeah.
And things in life, we have to put our focus back on competency, back on people, back on the things that are important. And we're pulling all of that away. And it's frightening. Yeah. It's frightening to see what does that mean for my farm? Yeah. What does that mean for my family? What does that mean for our children and for our grandchildren?
Yeah.
And we've as the vast majority, because it's the minority, the smallest minority of our country that's driving the conversation right now.
Yeah. Yep.
And we, as free people in this country that work and provide and have value and faith and family and country and free enterprise and capitalism and the things that we know have made this country great,
right.
We're going to have to stand up, and we're going to have a voice to stand up for those things that are right. And if we continue to not have a voice in this country, we're going to continue to go the direction that we're going right now.
Yeah. We're going to get drowned out.
To me, that's completely frightful.
Yeah.
We have to understand that we're the majority. We need to have the voice. We're the ones. We're the ones that need to drive the conversation.
Okay. That's definitely, I think, one of the things I worry about too. And you're right. I mean, even in our firm, and we have offices all over the country, Just getting people that want to work and strive to work and understand the value of work, it's different. I don't know if it's the pandemic has sort of created a cultural shift or what's going on, but let's end on a positive note. Again, what is your definition of success in farming?
You know, that's such a great question. And that has changed over time too, right? Before it was, I was successful because I finally could pay my grocery bill.
Yep.
And, you know, and so, you know, and then success became, I got a updated tractor.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Or, oh, I landed a land deal or whatever. Success to me now is that when I can wake up and I can wake up in peace, knowing that my family's there with me, knowing that I'm healthy, and knowing that I have good people that work for me, that value what we have, that brings me peace.
Yeah.
That brings me joy.
Yeah.
It brings me a sense of satisfaction. It, to me, it's not the things that we have in life. Like, you can travel all over the world. You can own Rolexes and Ferraris and big fancy trucks and nice combines and all these things that the world puts as a high priority in life. But that's not what's important.
Yeah.
I tell my wife all the time that if our farm goes away, if everything that we have goes away and we still have God in our life and we still have a free country and we still have each other, we've got everything that we need.
Yep. Yep.
And
totally
that
agree.
Is a freeing, that's a freeing feeling.
Yeah.
And I would just encourage everyone that don't put the value of who you are as a human being in what you do. Put it in who you are.
Yeah.
Put it in the difference that you can make in the lives of other people. And whether that's your employees, your kids, your neighbor, your spouse, whatever that is, put your value back in people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And keep your perspective on that. And to me, that creates an immense amount of inner joy and inner peace.
Yeah. Yeah. And success. So,
no question.
No. Well, Ron, this has been great. You know, typically on the podcast, we don't spend as much time diving as deep into the history of the farm operation. And I've really enjoyed that today. You know, just hearing that story of both loss and then, you know, the ability to recover from that. So that's very, very welcome on this podcast. So I thank you for that.
Well, I sure appreciate the opportunity, and it's always good to visit with other, you know, people who are moving and shaking and doing positive things in America and particularly in agriculture. And so it's been a real pleasure for me to take the time to talk. And certainly, again, you know, if people want to reach out, my last name is spelled Rabou. They can find me on ronrabo.com or rabofarms.com.
Exactly. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.